Joseph Levine is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He is one of the world's most distinguished thinkers in the area of consciousness and philosophy of mind. In 1983, he wrote a seminal paper titled Materialism and Qualia, the Explanatory Gap. In this paper, he developed the philosophical framework and coined the term the explanatory gap to explicate the philosophical problem regarding the relation between the physical and the mental and how a physical brain can produce mental phenomena. This idea has now come to be known as the hard problem and has been famously further elaborated by David Chalmers. The explanatory gap and the hard problem has become a fundamental pillar in the debates of philosophy of mind, a debate that still rages and is as strong as ever regarding how, if, and to what extent the physical brain can explain the mind. As a consequence, this makes Joseph Levine one of the most influential philosophers of the last 40 years. He received his PhD in philosophy in 1981 from Harvard University. He is also the author of the book Purple Haze, The Puzzle of Consciousness, published in 2001 by Oxford University Press. The study of consciousness itself and the term consciousness has got a long historical tradition going back to the ancient Greeks, perhaps more 500-600 years ago under the domain of Christianity. Conscientia was only really attributed to the behaviour, the beliefs of someone's moral thought system. Then someone like Descartes came along and obviously proposed aspects of dualism, which today remain controversial. You could roughly say that in the 20th century, the study of consciousness and to a certain extent its accompanying features of mental phenomena and the mind that comes under the remit sometimes of psychology have kind of been split out under the scientific study. And one of them obviously is a neuroscience, which attempts to objectively and externally study the brain and its relationship to consciousness and potential relation to the mind. Essentially, we're not stuck, but they're two opposing viewpoints. One of them is that the mind and consciousness simply is the brain. Some people think that they are distinctly different. Some people think that they are different but are related. But first things first, as such a distinguished thinker in the area of philosophy of mind and consciousness, how would you first try to define consciousness?
When you talk about the long history of dealing with it, one thing to notice is that, so suppose you go back to Descartes. I don't like to talk about the ancients. I don't really have a good handle on their conception of lots of things. But starting at least in the era of modern philosophy in the Western world, I think consciousness and mentality were just identified. I don't think for Descartes, everything that would count as consciousness was everything that would count as mental. And I think it's only in recent times, probably since the time of the mid to late 19th century, when the very idea that there could be something like unconscious thoughts or beliefs or desires developed, partly because of obviously Freudian psychology, but also a lot because of the development of theories of normal functioning, the sort of beginnings of cognitive science. So when you have thinkers like Helmholtz talking about perception as an inferential process, obviously there's no sense in which the inferences that are going on in the perceptual system that he's talking about, for instance, inferring the three-dimensional layout of space of objects in space in front of us from the two-dimensional projection on the retina, that inference is not something that's part of conscious experience. We just experience the world in three dimensions, and it takes theorizing about what must be going on inside us to come to the conclusion that there's something like an inferential process. But of course, an inferential process, a process of starting with data, posing a hypothesis and confirming it, is a mental process. It's reasoning, but it's clearly not conscious. So all of a sudden, there started to be a bifurcation between the general notion of mentality, which now could take the form of being either conscious or unconscious, and conscious mental life. And of course, the more we've discovered, and I'm skipping over behaviorism because that just eliminated the mind altogether. But once we get into skipping from the 19th century to the modern cognitive science of the mid-20th century, the more we find out about the mind, just in terms of percentage of mental activity there is, more and more of it goes under unconscious, right? It seems it's only, a thin layer at the top that's conscious. So in that sense, there's been a huge shift in the understanding of consciousness itself, which used to be just mentality and now is some very specific form of mentality, and in fact, a form that may not even be of the most important explanatory relevance to explaining our, you know, our behavior and the like. So that's one thing I want to mention. So now, given that bifurcation and given that we know there's such a thing as unconscious thought, what distinguishes something from being conscious? And here I do think there are really two criteria that are in a kind of tension. And to a certain extent, I think this is something, I think Ned Block is somebody that you've interviewed. And Ned Block is famous for having introduced this distinction between these two notions of consciousness that he calls access consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. And I have, you know, some mild differences with him about exactly the way he carves that up. But I do think he's right that there is one notion, and this comes up in most of the time when you use the word conscious or consciousness in colloquial contexts. You say, you know, were you conscious of that? Did you lose consciousness? Did or regain consciousness? And usually in those cases, though, that's what Block means by access. So conscious then becomes something like some very high level. Sometimes it's associated with a model of executive control. But again, insofar as colloquial, it shouldn't be restricted in any particular model. But we do have this idea that the mind has these various faculties, but there's some homunculus somewhere up there that is at least performing some kind of executive function. And insofar as something going on in your mind is accessible to that executive function, then it counts as conscious. So if you're able to report it, if you're able to use it in explicit deliberation, those tend to be the most important criteria. So that's one notion, and that's obviously a very important notion. But then there's this other notion that Thomas Nagel famously captured under, again, a colloquialism, but with the phrase, what it's like. And we all recognize it's something children are very sensitive to. I remember as a child, there being, you know, these two big questions I had. What's it like to be a dog? And what's it like to be a rock? And it really was a question for, like, from the inside. What would it be to have a first person inside perspective on the world that is my dogs? And I think we all think, well, there probably is an answer to that, but one that may be inaccessible to us. But then you start asking, well, is there something it's like to be a rock? And of course, most of us think, no, the answer is nothing. So this feature of there being something it's like, which sometimes is described with the term having qualitative character, but I think that actually doesn't completely capture it. Sometimes it goes under the notion of there being a subjective perspective or something of that kind. That notion, I think, is, of course, the one that has given philosophers the most trouble to pin down, to incorporate into a materialist framework. And it has some intricate and intimate connection to the access notion, of course, but it's not exactly the same because the pure access notion doesn't seem to come with all the problems about integrating into a materialist framework that this, what Ned Block calls the phenomenal notion, which is the one associated with there being something it's like. So I think what we mean by consciousness is kind of ambiguous between those two, but insofar as you're a philosopher working on the problem of consciousness, it's most likely the phenomenal sense that you have in mind.
Now, leaving the issues of, might come back to the unconscious if we've got time, but leaving the unconscious processing aside and what ramifications that has on potential causation, its relationship between the mind and the brain, and then if that relates to in any way to access and phenomenological consciousness and the difference between that and obviously free will and causation. The explanatory gap is an area in which you've gathered quite a lot of attention since it was first essentially published in 1983. Now, I'll let you explain succinctly the explanatory gap in your own terms, seeing that it is a framework that you coined. But from my perspective, just to give a very rough run through, because this is not the essential point I want to ask you after you've made your classification, explained it your own work in your own words. But essentially, it's the idea that this mental phenomena that we have, whichever way we're looking at it, defining it, can't be not necessarily solely explained by the physical brain, but there's a problem in trying to explain this mental phenomena in terms of whether it's just qualia of first person perspective, the idea or notion of the self, or whether it's just some kind of first person phenomenological experience, or what it's like to be Joseph Levine, or what it's like to be Tony Sobrato. There's essentially a gap between reducing that to the physical brain. Now, some people think that this ties into an area of the problem of, to a certain extent, definitions and semantics, and people that you would also know that to a certain extent would oppose this would be someone like the Churchlands and quite famously Daniel Dennett, who essentially says, again, a rough outline, which is that qualia is part of this kind of like cult pop phenomenon, pop psychology, folk psychology, that it's not really a problem, it doesn't really exist. This idea of the self that you think is an internal subjective experience can just be reduced to brain modal states, i.e. qualia in a hard problem isn't a problem. So essentially, first of all, explain in your own words your own work of the expansion gap, and secondly, what you would say to those people that say that there isn't no expansion gap and there is no hard problem.
So when I first sort of coined that term, the impetus for that was I was writing in a time when the discussion in philosophy of mind, specifically around the mind-body problem, was dealing with theories that were framed in terms of identity claims. So you had what was famously called the identity theory, and the most perhaps famous exponent of that was J.J.C. Smart in a very important article called Sensations and Brain Processes back in the 50s. And he was saying, look, take some conscious experience, and his example was the experience of having a yellowy-orange afterimage, right? So we all know what that's like. We all have had afterimages, and it's not hard to figure out what it's like if they're yellowy-orange. And he said, I want to defend the claim that that very state, that experience thought of as a state of me, is identical, is the very same thing as a state of my brain. And what state of my brain? Well, that's up to neuroscience to figure out. Then other theorists came along, and within, I think a friendly amendment, as it were, to his view was actually it shouldn't be thought of as a state of the brain. It should be thought of what's called a functional state. That is a state that could be defined more abstractly and could be realized or embodied in a brain, but also possibly could be realized or embodied in a physical system made of composed differently, like an electronic computer. Both of those, even though functionalism was often opposed to the quote unquote identity theory, they were both identity claims. It's just they were identifying the experience with a different state, one with a particular physical configuration, another one with a functional configuration. Both of these were friendly to a materialist viewpoint on the world, and there are certainly differences, and I'm not saying there wasn't some debate about that, but in both cases, they were agreeing that there's a way of reducing this what it's like kind of state, what it's like to have a yellowy-orange afterimage, to something that can be described fairly objectively and fully in either physical or more abstract, but basically physical terms, and that was the functional terms. And then a lot of people had objections to these identity claims, and often they came from what are called conceivability considerations. You know, I say A equals B, but somebody says, but wait, it seems conceivable that you can have A without B. So that led us into the realm of semantics, philosophy of meaning, issues about necessity and contingency, right? Just because something's conceivable, does that mean it's possible? And do identities have to be necessary or not? And this engaged at the same time the new literature that Saul Kripke had initiated and also Hilary Putnam about thinking of necessity and differently than it had been thought of before. And I just kept thinking, you know what, there's a way in which pushing these conceivability arguments into essentially semantic arguments is somehow missing the main point. And so I wanted to go and say, look, I don't think this has really anything to do with the nature of identity claims or any of the sticky technical semantic and modal, having meaning, having to do with possibility, necessity, features of these identity claims. I think something else is going on. I think the problem is that there just seems to be a basic contrast between most of the theoretical identity claims we accept, like standard philosophical example, water is H2O, and any of these mind-body identities, like experience of yellowy or after image is brain state B. And it seemed to me the difference was that once we understood what H2O was, and once we knew that, where that involved knowing obviously something about physical and chemical laws governing H2O molecules, we could explain anything there was to explain about water. Why it freezes when it does, why it boils when it does, why it turns to vapor, why it, you know, I mean, all, basically everything, why it quenches thirst, why it, living things need it, all of that could be explained pretty clearly from just knowing that it's H2O and then, of course, the relevant surrounding facts. Whereas it looked like there's just this in principle bar in these other claims. Maybe you could convince me that this experience really just is a brain state metaphysically. You know, somebody said, what else could it be? I'm still going to wonder, but why should it be yellowy, feel yellowy orange as opposed to reddish brown? When I appeal to the nature of the neural configurations or even the functional relations that functionalists appeal to, there's nothing that actually says, oh yeah, so I see that's why it has to be yellowy orange. That's why it has to feel like this. It feels totally arbitrary and mysterious. And that was the gap that I was trying to capture and remove things actually from it being a matter of semantics.
Now, the second point of that is, what do you say to people, and there's quite a few, and I'm not talking, we'll leave neuroscientists aside for the moment, but a lot of philosophers of mind that say that this isn't even an issue in the first place. The hard problem isn't an issue. There isn't an explanatory gap. So what if there's differences in the way you see or experience orange in the way I do? There's obviously going to be a little qualitative and subjective difference between how dog A sees the blade of grass and how dog B sees the blade of grass. What do you say? What would you say to people that say there is no explanatory gap? What Joseph Levine has to say?
Well, you know, at some point, argument does give out here. I know Dan Dennett, and I know, and George Ray is another, is a good friend, and I know him. And we go around on these things. George and I do more than Dan Dennett and I. But so there's a certain way in which it does feel like there's some basic level of, are you going to take this seriously or not? But let me back up and say a little more than that. First of all, so there are actually two ways of responding to the idea that there's a gap. And I do find them interestingly different in the literature and not always distinguished. One way is to say, actually, you're just muddled. We can explain everything there needs to be explained. And then there's another position, and this I associate with Ray and maybe Dennett in certain moods. I'm never totally sure exactly where Dennett stands on these things, which is to say, no, there's actually, it is true, there is something you have in mind when you have in mind this experience to which the explanatory gap seems to apply. You do have something in mind, and that thing cannot be explained by appeal to the underlying physiology or functional organization. But that thing is an illusion. That thing is an illusion that there are just certain habits of mind that for some reason we're just designed to produce that just keep producing that illusion, that we actually know what we're talking about. So if there's an old article of Dan Dennett's from the 70s, I think, I don't know, 70s, early 80s, called Why You Can't Make a Computer That Feels Pain. And of course, that sounds like it's going to be a kind of anti-materialist sort of article, because it looks like he's saying, no, you see, pain is so special. But actually, what he argues in that article is we have an incoherent notion of pain. That's why you can't make it, because there's nothing that can actually, including ourselves, that can actually satisfy our notion of pain. So we're just under a certain kind of cognitive illusion when we think we're talking about this phenomenon that, in fact, couldn't possibly be a feature of anything that actually exists. Now, that's a bit like having an argument with a Freudian psychologist. So you say, I am not motivated by this repressed desire. And he says, see, that very behavior you're displaying, that shows that you're so I don't know how to convince someone that, no, actually, I'm pretty sure that I see, I have the experience. It's undeniable to me. I know what I'm talking about, and that thing cannot be explained by this other stuff. When someone says, yeah, that just shows how strong the illusion is, I don't know exactly how you break out of that dispute. But I'm not prepared to believe that when I have this notion from my first-person perspective, that there is this domain of phenomena, experience, which is very real and as epistemologically close to myself as can be, that it's all an illusion. I'm not prepared to buy that. That may be a fist stomping on the table, but I don't think that accusing me of having an illusion is any has anything more going for it.
It's a valid point and well reasoned. What about if someone doesn't necessarily meet you in the middle, but isn't as extreme and aggressive as Daniel Dennett is? So, for example, there is clearly a paradox in saying that this inner subjective experience that both Tony and Joseph Levine are experiencing right now as they talk about the area of consciousness is an illusion, yet simultaneously, phenomenologically, they're experiencing this first person experience. So how can this be an illusion if it's actually simultaneously happening right now? Okay, logically and philosophically, I get that argument, and that's fine. To a certain extent, that's why people have problems with this area of being an illusion. Someone might say, oh, that's because the illusion is so strong, but that just kind of stretches the argument further instead of actually trying to meet it in the middle.
Right.
What about the idea, because it depends how people articulate these points.
Right.
What about the idea that it is an illusion in terms of right now we are actually experiencing this inner experience. Right now it's just gone 3:30 in Massachusetts. Right now it's just gone 8:30 in London. This is a real experience that we're experiencing. It's not an illusion in that respect, but it is an illusion in the sense that there is a unified self-person identity of Tony or Joseph Levine, and it's something that Michael Graziano at Princeton would elaborate on better than me, but essentially this idea that we have this unified first-person experience is the product of modal brain state. So on the one hand, it's not as aggressive as saying it's a complete illusion, which sounds a bit paradoxical, but it's also saying that what you really think is yourself and this kind of inner world is just the residual consequences of a material brain and firing in the neurons. Now, okay, that still doesn't answer the point about how you still have this inner experience, because you clearly still do. The point that the illusion happened is the fact that there is this unified Joseph Levine or a unified Tony Sabrata, because if we take certain substances, if we have brain damage, it's different. Does that at least appease some of your argument or not?
So actually, the thing about the unified self is interesting. It's funny, despite being a very, what you might call, hardcore realist about phenomenal conscious experience, I am not actually that hardcore realist about the self. And I'm very sympathetic to positions about personal identity like Derek Parfit's. That is, I'm actually quite willing to acknowledge the possibility that a notion of a temporally continuing unified self for which there are principled issues about whether it survives or not. You probably are aware of these, you know, all these thought experiments about, you know, bifurcating brains and, you know, storing memories in a machine and then, and all of that kind of stuff. I'm quite actually willing to agree that there may not be the kind of principled fact of the matter about, is this thing 10 minutes from now really me or not for some of these cases. I don't think the issue of the reality of phenomenal experience and its relation to the underlying neural hardware depends on having that kind of robust notion of a continuing self. So I would want to separate those two. And I actually have reasons for thinking there couldn't be the kind of robust self that I actually agree we probably are under illusion we have. Nevertheless, I like to think minimally about momentary experience. I mean, so right now I'm staring at my computer screen and it's in Skype. And so since I'm not seeing you, we don't have video. I see this blue circle with the schema of a person in front of me, right? So just look at that. Take that experience right now of that blue circle that I'm aware of. I do think the experience, there's something it's like. For me now, whatever me is, and I'm willing to admit that I don't have a totally clear idea what a me is, but there is a structure here of something is presented to me that I'm aware of, and it has a certain qualitative character to it. That, I think, is divorceable from any substantive theory of what the self is. Okay, so that's one distinction I want to make. The other distinction I want to make where, because you talked about things arising from the brain.
Yes, it's always controversial. Yeah, go ahead.
Is I did want to say, and you probably have heard this innumerable times before, it is very important in this debate to make a distinction between causal and constitutive questions. So I have no doubt that my seeing this blue circle in front of me right now is a result of brain activity. Right. I have no doubt that if you took an electrode and zapped the appropriate part of my brain, I would stop seeing the blue circle. Right. That it is a result of that. But of course, that's not the philosophical debate. The philosophical debate is whether that experience of seeing the blue circle is identical or is at least realized in or constituted by what's going on in my brain. And of course, getting clear on that distinction has not always been easy. And I have to say, the scientists in the debate are often not as clear about that as the philosophers are. You know, we have to have something to contribute. So those are just two comments I'd want to make in response to somebody who said, I mean, especially when you use the word vestigial, you know, you feel like, yes, that, of course, a result. I have no problem with that. But that's not really what's at issue here.
To say that this subjective inner world that we have it is an illusion is obviously paradoxical for the reasons I just mentioned. It's just how, to what extent you define this illusion. Like you said, the area of the unified self is something that you could probably reasonably get to grips with, but saying that your whole subjective experience, even, I mean, clearly you don't experience yourself as the same person you were when you were 10 years old. Obviously you can,
right,
you can just see that straight away. So you're willing to give that a bit of room, but saying that the whole thing is an illusion is obviously quite paradoxical. And that leads me to this next point, which is to do with definitions in general in the area of philosophy of mind, because obviously earlier you talked about how a certain considerations in semantics obviously first brought you to the area of the explanatory gap. Someone like John Hall's work on mental causation is an area that I'm quite sympathetic to in terms of to what extent are the definitions here paramount in terms of the questions that they potentially ask and therefore the answers they can potentially produce. Because if you're saying that the mind is different from the brain, then you're defining the mind in this particular area, and it's something that you have done and some people that do think the expansion gap's a problem. Other people would say that, well, no, I mean, and it goes back to the idea of where the problem is with the expansion gap. So one of them is the illusion that we've already covered. The other one is, oh no, you're just generally quote unquote confused. The other one is, oh no, you're just defining this kind of experience, whether you want to call it access consciousness, phenomenological consciousness, first person qualia, that just literally is a brain state. There's no need to separate the two. They are literally the same. So it looks like both ends of the spectrum fall into the problems produced by the landscape of definitions. So on one hand, you're defining the mental and this subjective experience as something different from the physical. On the other hand, you're literally defining this qualia and subjective experience as literally the same as a physical. And that's something that John Hall in the area of mental causation says, that some of these problems are just generally problems of taxonomy, and you could look at them either way. You could be a complete materialist or, to a certain extent, at least a property dualist. How do you feel about some of these areas?
One caution about the notion of definition. Normally, in the philosophical tradition on where the notion of definition is used, definitions are supposed to be a priori. So, I mean, you know, the or analytic, you know, the parade example that philosophers love is the definition bachelors or unmarried men. A definition is supposed to often capture what it is somebody knows when they know the meaning of the word, when they have what we might say competence, semantic competence with the word or the concept. So you don't count as knowing what a bachelor is, right, unless you know that anyone who's a bachelor has to be male and unmarried. But then there's another notion of definition, where it just means any true identity statement. So water is H2O. So now the question is, do you want to call that a definition or not? Now, you could say, yeah, it's the scientific definition. Again, it's a word. People use it colloquially. I think calling it a scientific definition many people might be happy with using that phrase. And for most purposes, I can't see any harm. But it isn't definition in the a priori sense. Nobody thinks that in order to be competent with the very notion of water, you have to know that it's H2O, right? Children, people all over the world who have never learned any chemistry, nobody thinks they don't know what water is. Nobody thinks they don't know the definition of water. Of course they're competent with it. They just don't happen to know this piece of scientific fact that water is composed of these little H2O molecules. So I don't think anyone thinks that any kind of mind-brain identity statement is a definition in this traditional sense, because after all, that has to be empirically discovered. It's not a matter of competence with the concept or the term. It's a matter of discovering some facts about the world, given you already understand what the terms are. So I just want to make clear that in the traditional notion of definition, these other things wouldn't really count as definitions, though sometimes they may be described that way. So what somebody might be meaning when they say it's just a problem of how you're defining it is you might mean something like the following. You've got this notion of a phenomenal or qualitative property like, you know, reddishness, you know, what it's like to see red. And of course, if you characterize it in such a way that it couldn't possibly be a physical thing, then of course you're going to find, guess what? It's not a physical thing. Whereas if you reconceptualize it in another way so that it can be, or it doesn't rule out being reducible to something physical, then you'll find the explanatory gap goes away. So you might say the explanatory gap is a symptom of how you're conceptualizing something or certain decisions you're making. And I guess I want to, insofar as people are blaming the problem on a mode of defining or conceptualizing something, it seems to me connected with the idea that some of these questions are really conceptual or semantic decisions we have to make. So let me give you an example. It may seem a little far afield, but I think it connects with what you're asking. So one problem that the problem of consciousness seems to give you a real headache about is the problem of other minds. So it seems pretty easy to tell on straightforward third-person scientific grounds whether a creature that you're dealing with has sort of certain kinds of cognitive states or not, because you know it's whatever the best theory of their behavior is, right? There's always skepticism possible, but that's just blanket background skepticism. If you have a good theory, you have good grounds for attributing. So if we went to another planet and we saw creatures made of completely different stuff from us, but it looks like they build buildings, it looks like they communicate, they've got a scientific community, all of that, we have no doubt that there is something like thoughts and meaning and the like. But then we say, yeah, but when they look at red, is there something it's like for them? Or is it the same as for us? How would we ever know? And some people want to say, that's a matter for us to decide. Are we going to extend our concept of phenomenal consciousness to them or not? That's a kind of conceptual or semantic decision to be made. And if you do it one way, then they will count as having states like ours. If you do it another way, then they won't. But in the end, who cares? It's just a matter of how we decide. So I'm assimilating that kind of view to the sort of challenge that you were pressing against me. But I want to say in that case, and I think it applies to the sort of challenge you were talking about, I think it's patently obvious that there is what we might call a genuine fact of the matter at issue here and not a matter of deciding how to talk. Is this creature, is there something it's like to be this creature and what is it like? That seems pretty obviously to me a genuine factual matter, as factual as any other kind of matter that I can imagine, and not something that is subject to semantic or conceptual decision on my part, and therefore not not a matter of definition.
But essentially a simple brute fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Well, whether it's brute or not, of course, is a further theoretical question where if brute means irreducible. But I do mean genuinely factual.
Yeah, yeah. But it also ties into, we can't get into all the philosophy of science.
Right.
But a lot of the stuff also ties into conceptual realism, conceptual anti-realism, in what way these concepts tie into the world.
Right.
At the top of the hour, you elaborated on the difference between conscious experience and unconscious experience. Obviously, when we're asleep at night, there's lots of unconscious processing going on that we're not consciously aware of as a kind of first-person phenomenological experience. How does that then tie into aspects of the expansion gap? Because if the bits of the expansion gap at a very basic level are the gap between this what's it like kind of attribute of one internal mental phenomena versus the physical property of the brain that more likely than not produces it, on the one hand, is something that can be aligned with access consciousness. So if on the one hand your conscious experience has an expansion gap to physicalism, what about unconscious processing that you're not actually aware of itself? Does that mean in that area that the expansion gap is void, or does it still play a part in seeing that you're not really aware of what it's like for unconscious processing to work? How does that relate to the expansion gap, if at all?
I think not. I mean, and this is where, you know, Dave Chalmers and I would probably agree about, I mean, what I'm calling the area where there's an explanatory gap is, I think, pretty much what he has in mind by the hard problem. And then he talks about easy problems. Obviously, he doesn't mean really easy, because obviously there's some incredibly thorny, just straightforward scientific issues about understanding how perception works and all other sorts of mental processes. But I do think he's right that if you strip off the question of the domain of phenomena for which it makes sense to talk about there being something it's like to undergo that phenomena, and restrict yourself to the kinds of processing that, as I, you know, that in the tradition of Helmholtz and others, you know, attribute sort of computational capacities to our perceptual system and our most of our deliberation system too, which goes on unconsciously. I don't think these same kinds of issues arise. I think they're thorny scientific questions about, well, just how does that processing work? How is it implemented in neural structures? There are lots of gaps in our theorizing about it, no doubt. But it isn't this particular problem, the one that subjective conscious experience poses. So I do think, yeah, when it comes to the unconscious, the explanatory gap just doesn't enter in.
That's why some people might start to question the actual validity of this first person consciousness in general. If
right.
One doesn't relate to the explanatory gap, the other one does. But we've already covered that. Obviously, a qualian subjective experience, especially a first person experience, regardless of, you don't even require self-awareness or introspection. As I was speaking to Thomas Metzinger about this last week.
Mm-hmm.
But what essentially is the difference between aspects of the explanatory gap and Chalmers's hard problem when it comes to qualia and consciousness?
I really don't think there's any difference. He and I differ. I don't think we differ in identifying where the problem lies. In fact, I'll never forget when he actually sent, when he was still a graduate student, he sent me a draft of his thesis. And I remember looking at it and saying, God, this guy looks at the world very much the way I do. So I think our notions of hard problem explanatory gap are very similar. I don't really see any difference. We differ in where we think what follows from the existence of this gap. He thinks that he has an actual argument that takes you from the premise that there is this gap to a conclusion that materialism must be false, and it goes through certain semantic theories of his. And I don't like the semantic theories, so I don't accept that argument. Nevertheless, I probably end up in a position that's very similar to his, but through a somewhat different argumentative route.
Have you got any papers or books coming out in the near future? I know you work a lot in philosophy of mind and metaphysics and certain modal problems and conceivability and possibility, but what are you currently working on at the moment?
You know, unfortunately, there's this incredible publishing lag from the time that you submit a paper, especially to anthologies. I have a couple of papers in the last year that have been finished that deal with aspects of the problem of consciousness, one on this notion of acquaintance called Consciousness is Acquaintance and Acquaintance is Consciousness, that I think Oxford University Press is putting out. This notion of acquaintance, which I don't know if this has come up in your discussions.
No.
But acquaintance is this term that I guess Russell mostly made famous when he claimed there is a fundamental difference between knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description. But I have an article where I argue that basically what Russell had in mind by acquaintance just is consciousness. That's what it is. It's acquaintance with something. And so I have that paper, but unfortunately it's forthcoming. And I also just, you might, because you mentioned panpsychism and we didn't talk about that, but you might be interested. I just published an online review. Are you familiar with the journal Notre Dame Philosophical Reviews?
Yes.
So just about 3 or 4 days ago, a long review of mine of this anthology on panpsychism just came out. It's a substantial review. It's about 4,500 words. And I actually try to chart a course of sort of locating my own views with respect to panpsychism. So you might find that of interest. And I also have a paper not too long ago where I actually try to lay out pretty clearly where Chalmers and I are the same and where we differ. As far as what I'm working on right now, the last thing I finished was this panpsychism thing. The next project, which being an administrator makes difficult to always find time to do, but my next project is a paper on this issue that has come under the title Cognitive Phenomenology.